Erev Tov. I want to welcome everybody to our ongoing series. I think this is our eighth or ninth lecture in our second year in the series on great Jewish thinkers, influential Jewish thinkers. We've had sort of a wide range of people who we are presenting, and I think this evening also is also a wide range. A very, very controversial figure, and I think in many ways a very unknown figure. I think everybody's heard of Mendelssohn, but I think there's a lot of misinformation about him. So we have an expert here. I'm sorry?
The composer you're talking about?
The composer. It's related. We have tonight an expert who did his PhD, really, on Mendelssohn, has written on Mendelssohn, Dr. Eddie Breuer, who now lives in Yerushalayim, grew up in Montreal, lived in Thornhill for a number of years. His kids were in Nitivot. Now one's already graduated the Army, one's in the Army, one is going into the Army. So he's been in Israel a while already, and he teaches at Hebrew U, got his PhD at Harvard under Dr. Tversky, and it's a pleasure to have him here. He comes by to Toronto to visit every once in a while, and on a personal level, it's a pleasure to welcome Eddie Breuer to speak on Moses Mendelssohn.
Thank you, Rabbi Kalman. Hope everyone can hear me. Okay. Always a pleasure, particularly when I look out at the audience and I think I know most people by name. It feels like I was not worthy to be the high school valedictorian. I was not that good in high school. But I guess if I would have been, this would have been the kind of experience of looking out and seeing all the familiar faces. When Rabbi Kalman and I began to discuss this lecture back in September, actually, I didn't really realize how timely some aspect of this would be. In Israel, at least, and I'm sure you know this, all of you, in terms of paying attention to what's going on in Israel lately, it seems that the Torah and its teachings have become synonymous, whether we like it or not, with intolerance and narrow-mindedness. And this is becoming more and more, I think, of a concern. Going back a few years when the Rabbanut started tightening up or changing or altering, whatever word you'd like to use, its policies on conversion, attitudes towards the Christian and Muslim minority in Israel, which came to a head when a certain rabbi put out a legal pronouncement that Jews should not be renting apartments to Muslims, to Arabs, be they Muslims or Christians. Of course, you all know in the news lately the whole question of exclusion of women in public spheres, which in some ways is far worse than what you actually hear here. When you actually hear some of the stories and what goes on, now forget Beit Shemesh, and forget some what are unquestionably just extreme circumstances. Even in the Misrat HaBriyut, the health ministry, in terms of their own award ceremonies, it's just incredible. This has really become, I think, a serious problem and concern, and of course ongoing issues of the allegiance of religious soldiers in the army. When you add it all up, there's no question that in Israel, again, what the Torah seems to stand for is exactly what I think many of us feel very uncomfortable with, which is, again, this idea of somehow it being intolerant and narrow-minded. And it leads, I think, to a fundamental question of, are the values of the Torah really compatible with Western and modern liberal democratic societies and liberal and democratic values? I don't know if I really need to spell that out for you, but I will, just in two words. When we think of a modern liberal democratic society, we think of a society that strives to guarantee equal access and opportunity to all its citizens, regardless of religion, gender, etc. And of course, societies that protect the individual and the right to think, believe, and worship as they please. And somehow these very fundamental values seem to be at issue here. And frankly, to put the point to it, here we are in the room. I was raised in Montreal, and as a Canadian, we all enjoy unquestionably the benefits of a society which protects exactly the values that I've just pointed to. So are we living in some kind of a disconnect? In other words, if these are the values that we clearly enjoy, and clearly we thrive as Jews, as individuals, as a Jewish community, well, again, I think you really do have to confront and think about the question of, are these really Torah values or are they not? Again, I think in Canada, maybe we have the luxury of treating these perhaps as more of speculative or theoretical issues, I must tell you that in Israel it's becoming more and more a sense in which the society really needs to struggle with this and does struggle with this, and therefore it becomes very important to think about. Why do I say this? Because I think the first Jew to really begin thinking about these issues is in fact the subject of our evening, Moshe ben Mendel Medesau, which is how he was named when he was born, later adopting formally the name Moses Mendelssohn. Now before, before I get into the biography and lay out some of his accomplishments, and then the last portion will in fact address this issue of the nature of Judaism, I actually decided this year to do things this year. I mean, I speak in a number of places, and certainly I've been here in Toronto, and I've been a guest of Torah in Motion. But I decided this time around to perhaps address the elephant in the room. Because I know what happens. I give this talk, and then at the end, you know, people are still bothered. There's something I didn't say. So now I'm going to say it. I'm going to raise it, and we'll see if it, you know, if it's a good idea or not. You will tell me certainly at the end of the evening. And the question, I'm going to phrase it in a number of ways. Why should Jews who uphold Torah and mitzvot devote an evening to listening to a lecture about Moses Mendelssohn? Why should Torah in Motion sponsor such a talk? And Rabbi Kelman, in fact, was nice enough this afternoon to send me an email. Someone responded rather negatively to this very idea. And I'll just say it. I mean, again, so, you know, I'm just addressing the elephant in the room. As I said, we're just going to be right open about it. You know, Mendelssohn is the father of reform, and therefore anti-Torah. And how Torah in Motion could do this, that is certainly what it is. So really, why should we devote an evening to this? Why should Rabbi Kelman have so graciously invited me to do this? After all, wasn't Mendelssohn an apikoros? Wasn't he, in fact, the father of reform? Didn't 4 out of his 6 children convert, therefore disqualifying his writings and teachings? These are the questions that people ask. Now, there's a long answer. That's not for tonight. That's a whole other talk. And maybe one of these days we should do that. And there's a short answer. And just what's interesting about the short answer is, when did Mendelssohn earn this reputation, if I may put it that way? What's interesting is that in terms of everything he wrote was published already in the 18th century. He died in 1786. Nothing new came out. There wasn't WikiLeaks and some sort of personal letters or whatever it may be of his that came out. Nothing of the sort. What he wrote, what he said, was publicly known and was always known. His children, the 4 out of the 6 that did convert, and some grandchildren as well, converted at the very beginning of the 19th century. So there's no secrets here. There's nothing new here to discover. And yet what's interesting is that everything I said, wasn't he apikoros, wasn't he the father of reform, what about his children who converted, none of that was raised in the 19th century as objections to him. The objections began historically in the 1870s and 80s. Again, long after his writings were known, long after everyone who converted. There's nothing new there. What it does, I mean, as a historian, there's nothing other, one must conclude, there's nothing else to say than clearly what happened was a change in attitude towards Mendelssohn that has to be explained on other counts. And in fact, that is that longer story, and it's an interesting story, but not the one I want to tell tonight. So that in the 19th century, whether it's Samson Paul Hirsch, or the Maharam Schiff, or Rav Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg, or Rabbi Kiva Eger, and these are all important rabbinic figures, and dozens of other local rabbis who, frankly, are lost to us in history, which is to say that I might dig out their names, but they're really obscure figures. They were quoting Mendelssohn, they were signing up and subscribing to his books. There was simply no objection made. Again, the objections came much later, and therefore have to be treated really separately as an interesting historical question. So that's the elephant in the room. I'm glad that we finally acknowledged it. It is interesting. It is very interesting. As I said, it becomes itself a subject of of historical inquiry. Okay, and now to the subject of the evening. So let me run through and introduce Mendelssohn to you and we'll try to take it from there. He was born in 1729, as I said, Moshe Ben Mendel, in a town of Dessau in Anhalt. In fact, in Anhalt is an area south of Berlin. His education was the education of other youth. His father was a sofer and his father was a teacher. And the education, of course, at that time in Cheder was effectively rabbinics, more rabbinics. It was Mishnah and Gemara. It was Torah Shebaal Peh. There was no formal training, certainly no teaching of Ivrit, not Ivrit Ba'anglit, not Ivrit Ba'ivrit. None of that sort. They didn't have the luxury of those kinds of debates. There wasn't even formal or systematic teaching of Chumash, of Nach, none of that. Effectively, once children were taught how to read after 1 year, basically reading the Chumash and reading the Siddur, that's it. After that point, it was Gemara, Rishonim, Achronim, Tur, Shulchan Aruch, etc. What one learned on one's own is different. And clearly, even at a young age, he took the time to teach himself Hebrew properly. Obviously interested in Mikra, in Chumash, in Parshanut, and eventually in philosophy as well. This is his upbringing. He lived in Dessau till he was 14, at which point he followed his teacher, Rabbi David Frankel, to the big city, to Berlin. And this is because Rabbi Frankel was invited to Berlin. Rabbi Frankel himself was an author of a commentary to the Talmud Yerushalmi, which is actually quite unusual. But it is to this day, if you look at the classical Talmud Yerushalmi, it's one of the two classical commentaries. So his teacher was a serious scholar. He was devoted to him, and he followed him to Berlin at the age of 14. Just to give you, I think, a little flavor of what it meant to live in the 18th century, when he showed up in Berlin, this young Moshe, or Moses, or whatever you want to call him, had no legal standing. And the truth is, he would not normally have been let into the city. You have to have residency rights. A Jew couldn't simply show up and live wherever he or she wanted. He was only allowed in, essentially, on the ticket of his teacher, which is to say that Rabbi Frankel was allowed to have a certain number of students. Today we call it a student visa, but it wasn't that. It wasn't formalized. He was allowed in only by the good grace of a teacher who would vouch for him, and of Jewish families who had residency rights, who would effectively also say that they would take care of him, you know, for his material needs, meaning a place to live and the meals. It wasn't a simple existence. It actually took Mendelssohn many years before he received formal legal status in Berlin. Aside from continuing his studies with Rabbi Frankel, who was also a Beit Midrash in Berlin at the time, he also began, I think, to read, and it's evident what he was sort of doing in his spare time, which is he taught himself German fluently, and beyond that, French, certainly a reading knowledge of French, and of English, apparently also Italian. He learned Latin, some Greek, etc. And beyond just mastering those languages, it's obviously evident that he read voraciously, broadly, widely. He's an autodidact. No Jew in this generation, at least, was attending university. At most, he sat in on an informal Latin class at the local gymnasium, you know, the higher, more humanistic high school. But that's it. His training was either entirely on his own or through some other Jews who had some of this, you know, these languages and textual exposure from whom he learned as well. But again, all very much in an informal setting. So he arrived in 1743 in Berlin, again, effectively had his years as a student. In 1750, he was hired as a house tutor for one of the wealthy families. This is how young Jews made a living, those who were, you know, talented and bright and could teach. So he was hired as a house tutor. The family who hired him happened to own a silk manufacturing business. And 4 years later, in 1754, he went to work in the other side of the... He went to work for the family business as a clerk in a silk manufacturing company where he remained till the day he died. His business, and he kept regular business hours. This was not... He did not have the luxury of us academics to sit with the books. He went from clerk to being, manager to eventually being part owner. and something of an expert in silk manufacturing. When the Prussian government needed someone to write, to help them formulate new policies in silk manufacturing, he was actually one who did it. When did he study? When did he write? And he wrote tremendous amounts, not only formal publications, but we have volumes and volumes of his letters. And the letters are substantive, thoughtful exchanges of ideas. He did it all in his morning hours, or, of course, in after work hours. And again, it's remarkable to think about what he accomplished in those kinds of circumstances. He, beginning in 1755, he befriended Gotthold Ephraim Lessing, a very famous German playwright, philosopher, theologian, in 1754, supposedly over a chessboard, but this is all, of course, these lovely anecdotes, but they're more hearsay than anything. But Lessing actually encouraged him to publish, and in 1755, he published his first German essays anonymously. He did all of his publishing, or almost all of his publishing anonymously, whether in Hebrew or German. He was actually a very modest, self-effacing individual. That first book that came out was quite good. People noted it, and then were somewhat surprised when they discovered who the author was, this otherwise unknown Jew named Moses, who is now using this name, Moses Mendelssohn. He published more and more. By 1767, when he rewrote the Socratic play, Plato's Phaedon, to sort of bring it up to date and deal with the issue of the immortality of the soul. It was one of the philosophical questions he was interested in. By that point, he had become, a first-rate European intellectual, which is to say his name was known and he was considered unquestionably from that point onward in that top rank of European intellectuals. And he really made a career for himself. Again, we're not talking about in Jewish circles now. I mean, in the German, Prussian, and then broader European Enlightenment circles. At the same time, precisely because of this fame, he also became very useful to the Jewish community as an advocate. It's exactly, something that the Jewish community knew and appreciated. For example, in the 18th century, there came to be something of a medical concern that those who fall into a very deep coma may be indistinguishable from those who've died. Now, how do you ultimately, establish death? There was a bit of this kind of panic in Europe at the time that perhaps they are burying people who aren't truly dead. And therefore, governments began to adopt the policy of not allowing burial on the same day, and in fact asking for some delay, even up to 3 days, on burial. Well, the Jewish community, for what it felt to be halachic and traditional purposes, felt that that this was not right, and that perhaps the governments could be petitioned for a waiver or an exclusion for the community. Who did they turn to write such a petition? Moses Mendelssohn, who was perfectly capable of doing it. Rav Yaakov Emden, in fact, turned to him. He agreed. He wrote the letter. And in fact, it helped. It did the trick. They did at least waive this requirement for the Jewish community. Privately, he wrote back to Rav Emden. Again, Mendelssohn was a very learned individual, learned rabbinically otherwise. And in a private correspondence, basically said to Rav Emden, between you and I could think of halachic reasons why this should be okay, and we could go along with it. Again, privately. Privately, Rav Emden also told them off and told them to mind your own business. So that's fine. I mean, they clearly had a disagreement on this one. But nevertheless, I think Mendelssohn felt a certain public responsibility, and this is what the community wants, and he understood why it was important. He certainly did it. Later in 1778, the Prussian government, like many Central European governments, were moving against or narrowing, if you will, what it is that Jewish courts could be, and actually taking away the authority of Jewish courts to deal with all kinds of issues, including issues of inheritance, which, of course, when it comes to money in any community, these are important issues, and these are issues of sensitivity. They would not allow Jewish courts to adjudicate such issues. They wanted very much the power, again, the Central European governments, to deal with these issues. And therefore, the Prussian government asked for a kind of a German code of Jewish law, so that their judges would understand at least what the Jewish, you know, halachot were. So they turned to the chief rabbi of Berlin, who turned to Mendelssohn to help him on this. Again, so they could produce in German a sort of short code, if you will, of Jewish law on certain issues pertaining to family law. In any event, this is sort of part of the public persona. But the thing I really want to emphasize is the degree to which he became, I would say, almost a visible Jew. Should, you know, we should appreciate it, and we should also appreciate what that meant. Again, he was someone who in his personal life remained punctilious in all areas of halakha. That meant, of course, not corresponding on Shabbat, and he was receiving letters. It meant all kinds of things in terms of his interaction with the German and European world. And remember that in the days before email, if one can imagine, and before all the kinds of, you know, telephones, how was it that intellectuals met and interacted in Europe? Well, letter writing. But they did something else. And this is absolutely part of their intellectual lives. People who would visit Berlin, and some would, of course, choose to visit Berlin precisely to visit the intellectuals there, would come and knock on his door. Often with a letter of introduction. So you got someone who knew someone who could sort of say, this is a fine fellow, and he's very interested in the philosophy of aesthetics, so he's very interested in Rousseau. Mendelssohn translated Rousseau. I didn't tell you a lot of things. Again, I don't want to keep you here all night. Again, Mendelssohn's range in work was really remarkable. Since I mentioned Rousseau, his German translation of Rousseau was the translation of Rousseau in German until something like 100 years later. Now, anyone in German who wanted to read Rousseau's second discourse on inequality was effectively reading Mendelssohn's translation. He was contributing again very seriously. So people would come, knock on his door, and sometimes it was Erev Shabbat, and it created all kinds of interesting situations. And this is how they interacted. They would sit in the salon. He would be gracious, and they would chat a little bit, and eventually people would move on. But because of his visibility, you also pick up, actually, if you pay attention, a degree of murmuring that's going on around him and somewhat behind his back. Quite frankly, I don't think it was entirely behind his back. I think he was well aware of it. Which is that you had all these European intellectuals looking at him and saying, something's wrong with this picture. Here is this rabbinic Jew, punctilious, and whatever they knew about Judaism, but they could see all the strange things that he did. If it's what happened on Shabbat, or what didn't happen on Shabbat, it's the sukkah that went up, whatever he ate on Pesach, and they would see these things, because they would be in and out of his home. They couldn't figure out how somebody so smart, so intelligent, who wrote German so beautifully, was really a top-flight intellectual, could still maintain all these strange rabbinic practices and habits. He really was. You see that there's a degree of puzzlement at best, and I would say almost a little bit of nasty murmuring at worst, where they basically were saying, how could you be a Jew and so smart? And how could you be so smart and accomplished and still remain with that? It really was a puzzle, and there's no question. He, for his part, remained proud to the nth degree of what he was. We see a great degree of both pride and strength, which I think very much stands in his stead. It came to something of a head, really, in 1769, when a young Swiss pastor by the name of Johann Lavate, who had visited him in the early 1760s, and apparently Lavate was something, if you don't mind me saying, a bit of a from evangelical type, what came to Mendelssohn's home and pressed him on, what do you think about the New Testament? And, what do you think about Jesus? Mendelssohn certainly had read the New Testament, certainly had thought about this, and gave whatever private answer he gave. In 1769, Lavate came across what he thought was a terrific book, which included in it proofs for the veracity, for the truth of Christianity. He has this book translated from French into German and dedicates the book to Mendelssohn. Full page dedication, you open the cover and there it is. And what is the full page dedication? old Mr. Mendelssohn, you with an honorable, stellar reputation, surely would agree that, you know, this book, you know, is at least worthy of reading. And since, as a Jew, you may object to these proofs, you'll at least honor us by explaining to us why we're wrong. And if you can't explain to us why we're wrong, because maybe you don't have a means of explaining or overturning these proofs for the truth of Christianity, then why don't you do the honorable thing? The honorable thing that Socrates would have done. The honorable thing that any intellectual would do, which is convert. In other words, you know, come clean. Now, I'm not going to tell you right away what his response was, but the very challenge, you have to appreciate what it meant to be a Jew in that context, with such public visibility. And yet, he handled it. He really did handle it. I think some of his closer non-Jewish friends around him were holding their breath. People, of course, were like tut-tutting. They felt that Levate had really overstepped his bounds, but be that as it may, I will get back to to his response. All this time, he was also publishing. He was publishing in German, but he was also publishing in Hebrew. He, in the 1750s, started what ended up being a failed attempt at a Hebrew journal. This was a new idea. It was basically a journal that was interested in philosophy, aesthetics, philosophy and ethics, and among other things, encouraged the study of Hebrew. The Haskalah, of course, became the revival of modern Hebrew begins with the Haskalah, and some of that actually absolutely emanates from him. But this was a failed effort. His three important Hebrew writings, number one was a commentary to Maimonides' Milot HaHigayon. Milot HaHigayon is basically a treatise on logic. The Rambam, Maimonides, wrote in Arabic, of course, because he wouldn't write logic in any other language in that era, took Al-Farabi's, famous Muslim philosopher and logician, took some of Al-Farabi's introduction to logic, recast them. Right? This introduction to logic has nothing Jewish about it, which is why people actually sometimes suspect that perhaps Maimonides wasn't the author. But that's irrelevant. It was always believed that Maimonides was the author, and Mendelssohn certainly believed it was the Rambam's, and he wrote an excellent commentary to this, bringing the book into the 18th century, explaining the German phrases or the German words, and again, just explaining the logical concepts that underscore it. Again, it's a very important book. Mendelssohn here also lays out what becomes sort of for him a very important argument, that why is logic important? He does make the case in the introduction that just what grammar is to speech in terms of articulating and organizing what we say so that you can understand what I have to say, is what logic is to thought. You know, logic is the means for us to organize our thoughts so that our thoughts aren't all over the place, so they're not random, so that A follows B and B, or B follows A and C follows B, and that one could actually analyze and think about what one is both saying and what one is hearing from others. This was actually something he felt very important. He felt this was actually a useful primer for school children, or maybe more teenage aged children, and he thought even teaching them logic an hour a day would go very far in their education. Beyond that, he wrote a commentary to Kohelet, clearly a philosophically oriented commentary, and last but not least, published a book formerly titled Sefer Netivot HaShalom, which was his German translation of the Pentateuch, of the Chumash, Chamishei Chumshei Torah, with his German translation, a lengthy Hebrew commentary, and also something of a Masoretic commentary, sort of like a Minchat Shai, which is very technical, which he included as well. There are a number of important things here. One of them, first of all, to tie together his commentary to Kohelet and his commentary to the Torah, is that even in the commentary to Kohelet, he goes out of his way to ask a very important question. What is the relationship of Midrashei Chazal to Pshat? What is the relationship, in short, I would say, of Pshat and Rash, of rabbinic interpretation and of good, philologically determined, you know, the plain or simple or straightforward interpretation of Scripture? And he actually gives a very interesting, articulate answer, which has to do, actually, for him, with the nature of language. In other words, he says, it's not just enough to say, well, you know, well, it's our tradition, which is clear that, you know, he's working off of that. There's no problem with that. He was asking himself, in good linguistic language, can you show that the Midrashim, that our rabbinic tradition, in fact, is rooted in the text? And he shows it, and he articulates that both theoretically and then also in practice very, very nicely. Okay? Why is he doing this? Because he, reading what Germans and Europeans have to say about rabbinic literature, knows fully well that they have nothing good to say. But the way in which rabbinic literature in the 18th century is handled, is, I could say in one word, dismissively. Okay? European intellectuals, who themselves are often fluent in Hebrew, who've made it their business, nevertheless dismiss anything that the Jews have to contribute to the interpretation of the Torah, of the what they would call the Old Testament. For us, it's the only Testament. And it was something he was sensitive to, because he was well aware that that is the perception. Now, he's writing in Hebrew. He's writing for a Jewish audience. He's not writing to refute. He doesn't even really want to, I think, start up or begin this debate with his sort of, you know, non-Jewish, largely Lutheran friends. Because for whatever reason, they may have privately decided this, who knows. But he felt that internally, given that Jews are integrating slowly more and more into European society, that it was good for Jews to understand how to respond, to understand that the tradition they have could absolutely be defended, not only because it is our tradition, but on good philological, solid grounds. And that's a very important endeavor that he begins. Even more than that, I've argued that his translation of the Bible into German, what you hear, and it's very unfortunate because it doesn't really have basis, is that he did it in order to teach Jewish children German. In Germany at the time, certainly in Berlin at the time, very much the opposite was the issue. He felt that most Jews could no longer open the Hebrew Bible and understand it. That's because people weren't trained in biblical Hebrew. This is a problem. I mean, I would say this is a problem even today. So how do we handle it today? What do many of us do, frankly, growing up, when we want to understand something in our own Torah? Well, it's called art scroll, or it's called whatever it is. We are using English because we feel more comfortable in English than in biblical Hebrew. I'm not saying this proudly. I'm just saying this is a matter of its reality. And he actually, in his introduction to the Sefer Netivot HaShalom, he very nicely and intelligently lays out a history of the Jewish study of the Bible. And guess what? When we needed to, we translated it into Aramaic. Why? Well, because Aramaic was our mother tongue, or the language we felt more comfortable in. And Jews translated it into Greek. And then they translated it into Arabic. And then they translated it into Ladino, and they tried, you know, Persian. And he goes through the whole bit. And he basically says, and now here I am, and the year is, the 1770s, because he's preparing this book. And he says, well, we have a problem in our hands. There are German Bibles out there. But guess whose? Luther's. Or more recently, in terms of the 18th century, Johann David Michaelis, when there's a series of other German Bibles. He says, those are unacceptable. He says, I already know that Jewish children are beginning to use those Bibles. He knows it. He knows it fully well. Because again, their Hebrew's not good enough. And there are German Bibles being sold at the bookstore down the road. But the problem, interestingly, wasn't only the Christological, you know, the nature of, certainly of Luther, but actually even true of Michaelis' Bible and of any of the Bibles. There was another problem that was brewing in the 18th century that, again, he was one of the first to really pick up on. Michaelis and other 18th century scholars, really fine scholars, by the way, I should point out, were already beginning to argue that the Masoretic text, what we call the Masoretic text, the text that has been preserved through the Masoretic tradition, Masoret Dolan, Tanakh, etc., was faulty, had become corrupted over the years. Much like, by the way, what scholars were doing with Homer, and scholars were doing with any classical literature. You know, texts over a couple of thousand years will unfortunately be corrupted, etc. He felt very strongly that that might be true for other texts. It is not true for the Hebrew Bible, given this Masoretic tradition that seeks to preserve it. So he, again, quite flatly said, we cannot allow our Jewish children to be using a German Bible prepared in the hands of people who don't necessarily uphold the traditions that we uphold, and he insisted, therefore, on the Jews producing their own German Bible, which is exactly what he did. Other, just very briefly, other small but important features. Again, he returns over and over again to this issue of the relationship of Pshat and Drash, meaning of and understanding the basis of Midrashei Chazal, of both, by the way, halachic and agadic. It's very important on both counts. He's also the first one to make serious use of Rashbam. I don't know if Marty Lakshin, Professor Lakshin, had spoken perhaps as part of this series, maybe last year, whatever it is. Rashbam is unquestionably an important medieval parshan, exegete. He was only one manuscript of the Rashbam survived into the 18th century. It was published, he wasn't the one to publish it, in the beginning of the 18th century, but no one really noticed it. No one made use of it. The first person to actually take the Rashbam seriously of the Torah was unquestionably Mendelssohn. Who, by the way, then also turns around and wraps the Rashbam on the knuckles gently. Why? Because the Rashbam didn't go far enough in defending Chazal. And anyone who knows Rashbam realizes that that's true. Rashbam cared about Pshutov Shal Mikra, said Mendelssohn, but a little too much. It's interesting. Again, he's trying because he has his own agenda. He has his own needs, and he realizes that Rashbam might be nice, but that's not what we need in our generation. And again, this issue of defending Midrash HaKadosh. As a footnote, by the way, I will point out, as I've said, Mendelssohn's concern here was what non-Jews, Christian scholars, were saying. Two generations later, the issue about the authority of Chazal was not an issue between Jews and non-Jews. It was an issue between Jews and Jews. As you had a new movement, which eventually was called the Reform Movement, questioning the authority of Chazal, guess what? Mendelssohn, in this case, was ahead of the ball. He didn't realize it, obviously. But his approach became incredibly useful. So that you go to one of the next major, certainly Shadal or others made use of Mendelssohn, but the Haktava Kabbalah, Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg, was the chief rabbi in Königsberg, who's writing a book to defend Chazal, makes use of Mendelssohn. It's clear that there's a trajectory here, that what Mendelssohn did in terms of defending it set off, I think, a very important 19th century trend. Okay. That's the biography, if you will. That's sort of introducing him, telling you who he was and what he was. I hope, you know, I've tried to cover all the bases. There's more, of course. But I was told not to keep you here past midnight, so let me move. His most interesting work, I think, in many ways, and clearly one that maybe, I mean, I'll just share this with you and then we can discuss it, maybe perceived as untraditional, although he would not have thought about it that way, is his book, Jerusalem, written in German, and I'll explain the context of it, and it appeared in 1783. It's exactly when he finishes his Torah commentary and translation, that whole project, he's also actually writing the book, Jerusalem. And it is the book, I will tell you now, going back to the beginning of my talk, where he takes up the question of, is Judaism compatible with modern liberal values, with modern liberal society? But let me pause first and tell you how he answered Lavate. Remember the fellow who said to him, either disprove Christianity or convert, right? He answered him by saying, you know, there's a difference, Mr. Lavate, between your tradition and mine. Because your tradition, Christianity, clearly believes that we Jews cannot attain salvation. We don't, in other words, get our chelek be'olam haba, unless we walk through the doors opened by Jews. Not so us. We accept that everyone has their chelek be'olam haba. We have no reason to convert you. We have no reason to discuss this. Any fine human being who embraces the fundamental truths, which I can touch on, the belief in the existence of God, the belief in God's providence, and the belief effectively is harva onish in the immortality of the soul, meaning that reward and punishment is something not only of this earth but of eternity. With those fundamental beliefs, anybody could gain their chelek in olam haba, and therefore I do not need to do what you need to do. What Mendelssohn, I mean, it was an interesting answer. He effectively was saying to Lavate, well, he hinted at the fact that if he had to disprove Christianity, he could easily do it. But that was the hint. That was just that little kind of elbow. But really what he was saying is that we should really stop with this nonsense. This kind of conversionary pressure is not important. And by saying that Judaism was not interested in it, he was actually saying that Judaism was far more enlightened than any, you know, than Christianity. And it was a very important note. He, I think, struck just the right tone. He was able to sort of, you know, be both proud of Judaism and you know, try at least to shame Lavate into what he did. I'm not sure Lavate got the hint, but in any event, that was his earlier response. What happened in that Jerusalem was published in 1783. I have to step back a little and give you a little bit of a blow-by-blow about how he got to write this work, because this was not a work he ever wanted to write or planned on writing. He was forced into this. He was effectively backed into a corner, and he knew that he could not remain silent, and therefore he writes this book. In 1781, a certain important Prussian government official, actually, wrote a book on the supporting the improvement of Jewish civic status. And Christian Wilhelm von Dohm. He writes this book. In the book, as a total aside, he says, look, the Jews should be given more, you know, their rights. We should create some civic equality for them. Of course, the Jews will continue with their own community, and their community will continue to use any means of policing itself, including the cherem, excommunication. This is... Dohm sort of lets loose on this. Mendelssohn, by the way, had read the manuscript. He was aware of Dohm's position. A year later, Mendelssohn enters the fray. He enters this whole debate about Jewish civic equality, and he writes a preface for, again, another book. I'm just cutting some corners here to save some time, where he says something very interesting. Now, first of all, I'm going to set this up, I think, in a way that this makes sense. Mendelssohn realized, what is the fight over for civic equality? What was it that Jews wanted? By the way, it wasn't Jews. I mean, because this campaign was so young still, it was really Mendelssohn and a few others who realized that government policies are beginning slowly to change. Governments are beginning to at least consider or reconsider the laws pertaining to Jews. And what were those laws pertaining to Jews? Well, there'd be one set of laws for everybody, and including taxation laws, right? Import-export regulations, and a whole other set for the Jews. Because the Jews were the Jews, that's it. So taxation laws were different, import-export regulations were different, everything was different. The question was, can we not create a society where there should be one fair, equal set of laws? Mendelssohn realized that at the heart of that debate, what you were saying effectively is that the government should not penalize a certain people because their beliefs are different. Penalized because you're being taxed more or differently, everything's harder, you have to apply for special licenses, etc., etc. Fair, that's really what was at issue. In other words, again, that you shouldn't pay an economic price for the beliefs you happen to hold dear, which of course Jews have been doing for a very long time. If so, says Mendelssohn, one has to be consistent. We have to be just as consistent within our own community. And here comes the rub. Should we really allow for cherem? What is cherem? Cherem was economic strangulation, in at least its most basic form. I can't buy from you, I can't sell to you. Now, for the most part, by the way, cherem was used only for economic measures. A classical example. If a Jew in town, in any community, refused to pay his taxes, or a family refused to pay, right? The Jewish community needs to raise taxes for two purposes. To run the Jewish community, the shuls, the mikvah, the schools, and because they owed money to the government, just for basic residency rights. So you have to raise a certain amount of money every year. Certain family says, sorry, we're not paying in this year. You're not paying in this year. Well, one of the means of getting the money out of them is economic strangulation. But that was fair. In other words, you're saying you have a certain debt, you have to pay up. The problem that bothered Mendelssohn is even the theoretical notion that cherem, excommunication, should be used for non-financial, non-economic kinds of issues. Which, by the way, it wasn't used for often, but he didn't even like the idea of it. Because again, it's the same principle that's at play here. Can you use, or should you be allowed to use, economic pressure or economic punishment because of the beliefs that you hold? So Mendelssohn, I think, was very sensitive, I think, to a point here of consistency. But frankly, He put it in more positive terms as well. Actually, there's a technical issue. He analyzed the whole question of rights, and really what he's using is 18th century sort of political theory. I don't want to get into that here. That does get more technical. But then he sort of offered a much more positive notion. He said, look, isn't the point of religion to bring people close to God? You say, of course that is. If so, let's say you harbor certain doubts. Harbor certain doubts, certain ideas you can't get your head around, certain things that bother you. He says, why? What sense does it make, because you have certain doubts and that you were honest about expressing, for us to then punish you and push you out of the synagogue? He said, that doesn't make sense to him. So again, in a very positive way, he says, the whole point of religion is, you know, to bring people closer. You don't push people away. He says, you can push people away in any other society, in a chess club, in, you know, for all kinds of things, but not when it comes to a religious body. And just to, you know, his quote here, true divine religion, he's writing this in German, true divine religion can never coerce. Again, you could instruct, you could draw closer, but you cannot force, and you cannot apply economic thumb screws. Okay. So he says this, this is in an essay of 1782. No sooner does he write this essay, a couple of months later, I think it appeared in March, in fact, by the summer, a few months later, he's told that he's about to get the challenge of his lifetime. Because there was a certain Protestant writer, we now know who it is, at the time this was anonymously published, who decided to challenge Mendelssohn on what he had just said. And the challenge is really just, there are two things that this pamphlet does. Number one, it says, come on, Mr. Mendelssohn, be real, be serious with me. You present Judaism as this kind of liberal, progressive, you know, you're talking about true religion doesn't coerce. They said, I don't know a more coercive tradition than Judaism. Right? Just open up the Chumash. Everything you do, you mechalel Shabbat, mot yumat, it goes on and on and on. He says, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what you're talking about. It's interesting, his tone, and now that we know who it is, this does reflect his position was in fact as a liberal Protestant. In fact, he embraced the idea of a modern, progressive, tolerant tradition. He just said that Mendelssohn, I don't know what you're talking about, you sound like us. But you're not certainly sounding like the faith of your forefathers, is what he keeps kind of challenging. But there was more to this pamphlet than just that. Because what he says then, and this is when he kind of puts the knife and twists it, he says, look, you, Mr. Mendelssohn, and your fellow Jews would like to attain a certain amount of civic equality. So it's very nice. I'd be very happy. But how is it going to come about? Is the 99% going to bend to the 1%? Or the 1% are going to accommodate themselves to the 99%? I mean, you know, let's be real here. It's very obvious where he's going with this. He says, if you wonder why you Jews are excluded, it's because you Jews exclude yourselves. You're so different. All your laws are different. You don't fit into our society easily. Point number one. Point number two, it's funny, he says, how Judaism's always been adaptable historically. And he gives a very obvious example. He gives a few examples, but I'll just use one here. What happened when the temple was destroyed? We all know, by the way, that the Korbanot, the sacrificial cult, takes up a good chunk of Tayag Mitzvot. Forget the exact number, but it's a good number. What happened when the Jews lost their temple? They dealt with it, right? You did. So you went on without it. He takes that and other examples as Jews accommodate themselves historically. Says the author of this pamphlet, good, Mr. Mendelssohn, shkoyach, he would say. Continue. Now you're at another crossroads of history. Adapt yourselves. And because you, Mr. Mendelssohn, are willing to give up on the cherem, you've shown that you appreciate that old-fashioned coercive Judaism will not cut it. That's it. It's clear that you're the man to now lead Judaism in the direction of some kind of reform and, you know, lead our way to a glorious future. Obviously, you know, this is quite some pamphlet to receive in your mailbox. And there's this wonderful haunting line where he says, one more step and you've become one of us. And there's no way Mendelssohn could let this go. He was furious. He was, you know, beside himself. But he could not remain silent. So he was effectively badgered into responding. Interestingly enough, this passage came with a postscript that someone else wrote and signed, which said that, you know, Mr. Mendelson, your preface, that essay that you wrote, when you talk about religion being of heart and mind, and he says, you know, I even have another question. I even wonder whether you believe in revelation at all. So once you're already answering all these challenges, by the way, why don't you come clean on that one? So now it ends up that postscript was useful to him. Why? Because he was able to use it. Alexander Altman and others have pointed this out, I think, quite correctly. He was able to use it as something of the way to frame his answer. He framed his answer effectively by saying as follows. It's true. We Jews don't believe in revelation the way you Christians believe in revelation. You believe in the revelation of truths, of ideas. We believe in the revelation of law. That's our revelation. And what he goes on to articulate very clearly in his book, Jerusalem, is, again, something that may surprise you, but it is certainly can be the subject of our discussion, is that the Torah does not command belief. The Torah commands what it does not tell you what to believe. It does not command belief. It only commands actions, what to do and what not to do. Now, to understand both how he does this, why he does this, and where he goes with this idea, let me throw out a few ideas. First of all, he felt, and again, what's interesting in his writing is that he's really consistent. He makes an argument here, you end up finding the argument everywhere in ways where he's trying to fit it all together. His first argument, made both here and elsewhere, is that he would find it difficult to believe in a God that said, you need to have the following beliefs in order to get your chelek be'olam haba, and then reserve those beliefs only for one part of humanity, or to deliver them only at one point in history. So that's not the God I would believe in. Again, he goes back to what he said to Lavate. All beliefs are available, all the fundamental beliefs, again, belief in God's existence, in God's providence, hashkacha, in eschar va'onesh, these are beliefs evident to all men and women at all times. And he went so far as to make the following few points. Number one, he said, if you really believe that, and he did really believe that, you cannot, for example, say that these are beliefs that are all rational in the sense that you need to have philosophical training. Why? Because then that would exclude a good chunk of humanity who don't have the luxury of the college education, the university education that some of us have had, and you know, who aren't necessarily all gifted that way. He says, no, these are truths that are evident both intuitively to even the most illiterate, simple person. In fact, Mendelssohn makes a lovely potshot against us academics, right? A few of us in the room. We're saying that sometimes we get a little bit too sophisticated for our own good. We could devise all the possible objections to every possible idea. This is nonsense. These are basic fundamental truths that can be grasped intuitively, as well as intellectually. But these are the fundamental notions, available again absolutely to every last man, woman, and even child. And that this is, of course, the goodness of God, that would both create a humanity where we are none of us are doomed. And all of us, therefore, have that equal opportunity. Similarly, he objected to this notion of a historical revelation of truth. This is very important. Meaning that God would come at any one moment, either at Sinai, or at the crucifixion of Jesus, or whatever that may be, and somehow use those opportunities to reveal those truths. Why? Let's say you happen to miss the event. Let's say you came the generation before Sinai. Let's say you happen to live in the West Indies, or the East Indies, or somewhere else. Again, he simply rejected and resisted this notion that these truths should come at any one moment in history. They have to, again, he repeats, and I repeat, they have to be eternal, and truly universal. And he insists on that throughout. Therefore, they were not what happened at Sinai. They were simply assumed to be, I guess, in our DNA, if you will, or in our very being, or at least the possibility of those beliefs. I'll read to you just so that you get a little flavor for his own writings. So allow me a few little quotes here. Eternal truths, he says. This is in part 2 of Jerusalem. Again, this is course, written originally in German. This is a very fine English translation of Alan Arkin. Eternal truths, insofar as they are useful for men's salvation and felicity, happiness, are taught by God in a manner more appropriate to the deity. I'll explain what that means in a minute. Not by sounds or written characters, which are comprehensible here and there, to this or that individual, but through creation itself. Hashemayim mesaprim kvodo is actually a line that he loves to use, and its internal relations, which are legible and comprehensible to all men. It's the heavens that speak to God. It's the world that speaks to God. God would not deign to take these fundamental ideas and restrict them to any one language or any one event. Another quote here. According to the concepts of true Judaism, all the inhabitants of the earth are destined to felicity, to happiness. And the means of attaining it are as widespread as mankind itself. There are an infinite number of means of getting there. And in fact, that's God created us with exactly all those means of doing that. Okay, so what about the beginning of the Aseret HaDibrot? Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt. Men also realize what all the objections would be, and he tries to at least deal with some of them. This is the first, that's not a mitzvah. So here he follows a tradition going back to the Behag, a Gaonic opinion cited in Ramban, and then he comes to Abarbanel. He has plenty of people to rely on, and he insists, that's right, not one does not have to read the Bible and take the first of the Aseret HaDibrot as a commandment, and he absolutely does not. And he even explains why it wouldn't make sense. What he insists is that when God said that, God was speaking to a people, Maminim, B'nai Maminim, to a people who already recognized that this was God speaking to them. But he said, speaking to them and saying, I am your God, and lightning and thunder, he says, would ultimately prove nothing to a skeptic. Okay? So he doesn't take it as a commandment, he doesn't take it as any kind of proof. Interestingly enough, again, he throws many different kinds of arguments, I think, or raises different arguments at this issue. He pointed out in the first part of Jerusalem, for example, on the question of oaths. Is there anything in Judaism, as opposed to, by the way, Christianity, where one swears to what one believes? As if one has to uphold one's belief by swearing to it? He says no. He says no. An oath in Judaism, a shrua, as we have in the Gemara, is not an oath about what we think. It's about things that are what he calls the external senses experience. It's what I saw or what I did. Now, it's true, of course, when one takes a vow, or an oath, I should say, in this kind of context, that you do invoke the name of God. But you're not swearing that you believe in God. You're not swearing to your beliefs. What he effectively says is, what really is the relationship of the words that I would utter to what's in my heart? See, that's a very, very tricky one. And of course, if you force people sometimes to swear that they believe X, Y, or Z, well, all you're going to do is increase hypocrisy. Because people will sort of say, well, I sort of believe it or I don't believe it, but it's useful for me to swear. So what he says about the Jewish oath is that I'm swearing that I did pay you back, or I didn't pay you back, or that I witnessed you doing this, or I didn't. When you mention God in such a context, why are you mentioning God? Only to remind yourself of the consequences of lying. It's all about schar va'onesh. You're not affirming a belief in God. You're just invoking God as a reminder to say, you know, yes, I saw you do this, or I did pay you back, or I didn't pay you back, and a friendly reminder that your words have consequences. But ultimately, you may want to lie, but you shouldn't. And you think about, you know, the ultimate. Okay, so this begins to lay out what again might be the most interesting and surprising aspect of his thought. Now, one could easily object and say, okay, so fine, the Torah doesn't command us what to believe or what not to believe. And you realize the effect of this. That means that the Torah is careful, in other words, not to put you in a situation of telling you what to think or what to believe. But the objection would be, it does command, I mean the Torah does command all kinds of religious acts, various rituals, and forces us to do them. He of course understands this. And again, it's interesting to consider how he tries to address it. First of all, with the question of avodah zarah, of idolatry. And here, he does something very interesting. He takes from early modern political philosophy the notion, and this is something I'm going to actually be in the Mizrahi Bayit on Shabbat, so this is actually going to touch and brush against something I will speak about there. So if you're interested, you are certainly invited, if I may invite on your behalf. He picks up an argument that effectively says, consider what the biblical commonwealth, what the biblical state was like. And if you don't mind, I will read here. In this original constitution, meaning in the Bible originally, and as it was originally formulated and lived in, with the Beit HaMikdash HaRishon, state and religion were not conjoined, but one. Not connected, but identical. Man's relation to society and his relation to God coincided and could never come into conflict. God, the creator and preserver of the world, was at the same time the king and the regent of this nation. Hence, I'm skipping a few lines, in this nation, civil matters acquired a sacred and religious aspect, and every civil service was at the same time a true service of God. Which is to say, there was no separation of religion and state in the classical sense. Now, what does this mean for idolatry, for avodah zarah? Again, I move ahead in this to the next page. Every sacrilege against the authority of God as the lawgiver of the nation was a crime against the majesty, and therefore a crime against the state. Whoever blasphemed God committed another quote. Under this constitution, these crimes could and indeed have to be punished civilly, not as erroneous opinion, not as unbelief, but as misdeeds, as sacrilegious crimes aimed at abolishing or weakening the authority of the lawgiver and thereby undermining the state itself. In other words, yes, avodah zarah was punished, but it was punished as treason. It was punished the same way any society takes a hard line against those who would disrupt the fundamental pillars of that society. So that's what was going on there. Now again, Mendelssohn wouldn't for a second deny that the Torah wants to teach us correct views of God. Absolutely. But teaching is one thing, and punishing, which is of course a way of coercion, is quite another. And he says, that's right, when avodah zarah, when idolatry was punished, it was punished not just for thinking certain thoughts, it was punished for speaking out and doing something that undermines society. And it was on that basis that it was punished. So that's one interesting argument that he puts forth. But really, he goes elsewhere, and even in a different direction. Was it really punished? And you can already anticipate, I think, some of you, what's coming. First of all, even though he doesn't do this, but I know that in certain places he must have been thinking of this, we have certain mitzvot, certain commandments, ben sora umara, but also ir hanidacha, which were never put into practice. So there's no coercion. It was never done. He goes further, though. He mentions explicitly the Mishnah in Makot, where Chazal themselves, the sages themselves, say, well, maybe a court convicted one in seven years, and others say, no, one in 70. And of course, the opinion there, some of the sages say, if we would have been on the court, they never would have convicted. Well, we have the issue not only of avodah zarah, but what about all the other rituals that come with explicitly stated punishments? Shabbat, etc., etc. Effectively, what Mendelssohn says, and here's sort of for him, for at least himself, the actual trump card, is that the din of hatra'ah, of warning, right, the need, before you are convicted of anything, you need to have two witnesses, even the same witnesses, it's a very complicated area of law, tell you that immediately before you do the act, that you shouldn't do the act, because that act will actually lead to you for punishment, because that is a requirement for any conviction. He says, and I quote here, what the Torah exhibits is superabundant indulgence for human weakness. In other words, if you read the Torah properly, if you understand what our tradition teaches, none of these punishments were ever carried out. In fact, we set up a situation What happens if you come to the court? You run to the court. I just saw so-and-so being mechallel Shabbat, desecrating the Sabbath. What is the first thing the court's going to say to you? Did you warn him? And of course, aside from the technical aspect, you know what the court is really saying? Did you step in and try to do something about it? Where's your sense of kinship and brotherhood? Where's your sense of social responsibility? But the point being, for Mendelssohn, is that, yes, the Torah says all kinds of things. But the Torah itself, in the way it's structured, was not interested in coercion. It was not interested in punishing you and beating you into doing things. Okay? So this is sort of, for him, a very important bottom line. In other words, as he portrays, you know, thinking now of the pamphlet that ultimately challenged him, he bristled at it. This pamphlet was basically saying, you, Mr. Mendelssohn, coming from such a coercive tradition. Mendelssohn says, what are you talking about? Our tradition, to begin with, doesn't even touch the issue of belief. That, we understand, is universal. We stay so far away from that. And secondly, even when the Torah says, you know, punish this, punish that, that's right, it's words. It's kind of like a parent threatening you, if you don't do this, you know, I'll come after you. But the parent ultimately shows loving kindness, indulgence, etc. He said it was not done. It's a complete misreading of what Judaism is. In other words, what Mendelssohn was trying to do clearly is get across a notion that the Torah was not interested ultimately in coercing. The Torah really was interested in teaching, in giving you a way of life, and pointing you in directions, but not in any shape or form in twisting your arm and in forcing you to do anything. So in other words, he got to say, in the way that he wanted to, is that the Torah, in fact, is the embodiment of some of these Western liberal values that were just then being articulated. They weren't even fully articulated yet, in some ways. And like his response to Levate, what he was trying to do is effectively say, who are you to teach us about these values? That these values are not even values that we are now pretending can be spliced onto the Torah. They're actually the values that the Torah comes and teaches in its heart and soul, if you will. Now, I think I've already perhaps taxed your patience, so let me just read, if allow me, the last few, or some of the last lines of his book, Jerusalem, and I will end with that. Again, do remember that Jerusalem is written against the Christian, and therefore what he's trying to defend here is the idea of you know, this pressure on the part of Christians, and him pleading as a Jew. But I think actually the message I think we could take home, and even if you remember how I began to talk in terms of some of the issues that I think we Jews need to struggle with and attend to, even within our own community. Says Mendelssohn, reward and punish no doctrine, tempt and bribe no one to adopt any religious opinion. Let everyone be permitted to speak as he thinks, to invoke God after his own manner, or that of his fathers, and to seek eternal salvation where he thinks he may find it. As long as he does not disturb the public good, and acts honestly towards the civil laws, towards you and his fellow citizens, let no one in your states be a searcher of hearts and a judge of thoughts. Thank you.
Okay, we'll take just one or two questions, not too long, and then, you know, probably if anybody has. Yeah, Dr. Shah.
Just a moment ago when you were talking about the idea that Hatorah serves as a call to involvement with your fellow Jew and not merely as a technicality. Was that you or Mendelssohn?
That was some of me. but what he's saying, but it's, you know, the issue of Hatra'ah he raises, of course, absolutely. He's raising it to say that this was exactly the means, you know, from, and we have this as part of our Torah Shebal Peh, of saying that this was never meant to be followed up. I'm saying, you're right, that's actually very perceptive of you to catch, is that the very act of it, though, invokes a degree of social responsibility that I think actually did speak to him. He didn't quite say it at that spot. But I think, I do think actually it's faithful, you know, to what he, you know, to what he wanted to see and the way he understood it. He had a very deep sense of community here and of Jews, which is, by the way, part of how he understood the whole, the part of, in Jerusalem, part of what he does with the whole idea of Torah Shebal Peh, I should point out that the pamphlet that challenged him was totally dismissive, of course, of anything rabbinic, as you could guess, is that it does exactly that. The whole point of Torah Sheba'al Peh is in part to engender a sense of community and to reinforce the fact that the way we truly learn is exactly by living in a community and learning from each other. He felt that the Torah Sheba'al Peh was the real, you know, living, breathing script, if you will, by which we live. So I think in that sense, what I said about Hatra is in the spirit of what he said. It's not the exact argument that he used. Absolutely. Good.
Was he not aware of the Mekoshe Shaitzim and the Torah, which gets killed? So how could he make such claims that there's no coercion? I mean, the whole thing just sounds it's such extreme apologetics. I mean, the Torah to deny. I mean, you can answer that.
No. It's a very fair question. There's no. Again, we can easily raise many issues here. There's no. I give you some examples of where he raises the objections. You know what I mean? Everyone's going to give you an argument and then raise some objections, and never, of course, raise all the objections. And that, of course, is absolutely fair. I think he would accept and understand. First of all, it's a unique and singular event. Again, because we have to counterbalance that off of Chazal, who say, well, they never did such things. Whatever it may be. And he would also say, ultimately, don't forget what he did say quite clearly. If at some point there is no separation of church and state, of religion and politics, ultimately the act of desecrating Shabbat has civic and civil implications. So I think, honestly, what he would probably say is that, that's right, that of course is in the Bible, that's recounted, it's recounted to teach us a lesson. But he would argue that was a matter of, in our society, we preserve publicly the day of Sabbath in the following way. If you publicly desecrate it, you are actually, you know, you are engaging in an act that undermines the public good. So now that's what I'm saying. Well, apologetic or not, that's certainly, and again, he says this so that I feel, you know, somewhat comfortable, in giving an answer. The degree to which one should evaluate this as apologetic or not is a fair question. I want to, you know, acknowledge that. And I think it could be argued both ways. Part of the question is, did he at least believe that this was in fact what, you know, that he was giving some kind of a clear and accurate reading of the Torah? Or was he aware, you know, that no, he had to say this? You and I both know that we could address the exact same questions to many great figures up and down the line, 20th, first century, back to the medieval era and earlier. It's a fair question. It's a fair question. One has to struggle with that.
So then, yeah. Don't you also have to ask the question of how this came to be defined as a public good?
Mm-hmm. Say that again? Sorry, I forgot.
Don't you then have to ask the question?
Absolutely.
But
every society.
How it then came to be defined as a public good?
Meaning, what's the deal?
In other words, it's not a religious, it's not a commanded good from God himself. It is part of your civic duty to do X. But how did this come to be defined as your public duty?
That is Torah Misina. He accepts that at Sinai we were told, we weren't commanded beliefs, but we were told how to structure our society. That's what Sinai was. It was, again, the revelation of law. From there, we were taught how to structure our society, also how to structure our private lives. You know, because, again, certainly, not only does he not accept that the Torah does not distinguish between private and public, between state and religion, it doesn't accept any of these. It ends up that life is one seamless, you know, whole, and we structure our lives accordingly. But that's right. That is our constitution. That is our constitution. He simply accepts, you know, Torah Misinai, but he accepts its content in dealing only with that. So that's its origin, that's its authority, and then we uphold it the way we uphold any state. Obviously, he understands that once the temple was destroyed, effectively that whole part of Judaism falls away. We all deal with that, right? We no longer have that civic backing. Our lives as Jews in North America, at least, is as, you know, is as private. It becomes a private endeavor. The question in Israel is, to what degree should it ever, and this is of course an interesting question, ever become again, you know, the public the public norm so that it becomes the means of structuring society. Obviously that's a very touchy question. It's a very interesting and complicated question. Interestingly enough, Mendelssohn knows that the first word that's going to come to our minds is the word theocracy. And it's interesting. He knows that, and he even says, he at one point in Jerusalem says, it's unfortunate that that word has gotten such a bad... We misunderstand the word, and unfortunately it conjures up for us, even in the 18th century, the worst possible connotations. He basically says that's unfortunate, but that one needs to think. Again, but you have to return to, for him, the idea of a biblical republic is for him the most indulgent, hands-off state. I want to repeat again, which he takes absolutely seriously. It is not a state that would ever really come after you and I, over whatever we do on Shabbat. He says quite explicitly, and this is by the way a Hobbesian notion and a 17th century notion, that the state could only concern itself with the most minimal and minimalist disturbances. Only true treason or only true acts that undermine our society does the state have to concern itself with. Everything else, the state should mind its own business. The state doesn't have, Trudeau's line about not sticking it, the state doesn't belong in our bedrooms. Mendelssohn would have liked that. I never put Mendelssohn and Trudeau together. It's the only place I could do that.
I'll write the lesson if I may. What changed? I know you didn't want to. I'll write in the 18th century. Sorry. If Mendelssohn was considered by the referendum, and today, why? Of course,
I have two different answers. Interestingly enough, what changed, and one of the things that Mordechai Breuer, no relation, pointed to, is that Samson von Hirsch's successor in Frankfurt was his son-in-law, Rav Shlomo Breuer, who's Hungarian. And we know about Hungarians. I'm not joking here. He would say that it's at that point that German Jewry began to change because of a certain Hungarian influence. Okay? Now, the one person in the 19th century who objected, of course, is Chazon Sofer. Sometimes that one thread, even if it's the minority thread, unfortunately that thread has a way of catching on. That's one answer. But the other answer is, who said that it really changed? Both Yaakov and I and many others that I encounter and speak with know, for example, that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky or Rav Ruderman and others owned copies of the Biur, never said any of these things. They never said any of these things. It's simply not true. It's a large degree of ignorance. I see that the people who are truly in learning and truly know,
Every Sefron's article in Jewish Observer 25 years ago.
Right, where he tried to say something nice and then got transported.
Say nothing, right. It's nice about Mendelssohn, got slaughtered.
Exactly. It's a very interesting... Listen, it's always useful to have someone to beat up on. That is true. It's very important to draw lines and to sometimes draw black and white lines because people are afraid of the gray. And they're afraid of, even though I don't see this as even gray... it just feeds on itself. But the point is that I have yet, I've certainly heard these objections, but I've yet to hear the kind of objection that you got in the email today that you so nicely shared with me, that he's the father of reform of the Franti Torah, who's ever read a word of him. That's the problem here. I'm happy, really happy to acknowledge, as of course I do, that there are complicated lines here, there are legitimate questions that need and should be asked. Right, but you read him and then you begin a discussion, and of course there's a critique that's available here. But to simply mouth off without knowledge, that doesn't do it for me on any thinker.
Last question.
Yeah, one more question. Is it possible also that the people who respected him, Eastern European rabbinic society that respected him, didn't really know what he stood for on political and even in his Jerusalem, maybe only saw his beer, which is pretty much a typical Pirush on Chumash, and he translated. So, in other words, maybe 100 years later, they started realizing, oh, this is what he stood for. Because a lot of what he stands for is not necessarily antithetical, but it's something that's good.
Jerusalem, I spent the good last part of this lecture on Jerusalem. No one read Jerusalem. No one, no one really, after he wrote it, the book was just buried. It's us academics. Yeah, but probably because I suggested that you read it. I mean, let's see. No, one of my, you know, old and dear friends. But by the way, the beer was printed almost 24 times. It was all over. It was everyone owned a copy of the beer.
There's nothing wrong.
Right. So the question is, what happened?
Philosophy is right. Much more.
But they never picked that up. But even the thing, what happened in the 1770s or 80s is not that someone finally picked up Jerusalem. They never picked up Jerusalem. People don't read it. It's one of these books, honestly, that only academics read. But let's just be, I just want to be really honest with you.
And it's because the Reform maybe took them as their guide.
That's possible, which is interesting enough. Sam Sefral Hirsch already had to deal with that and did deal with that. When they quoted Mendelssohn as their hero, he immediately jumped in and said, "You guys don't know what you're talking about." And then he started quoting Mendelssohn to show that, you know, that, you know, he would clearly have disagreed, that they had no business trying to appropriate him.
And maybe when they did, is what happened.
You're right. And that's, by the way, that is absolutely part of the story, too. I mean, that's why I said it's a complicated story, because you have to pursue this in a few different angles. But what's interesting is that even when they did appropriate him, it wasn't like the Orthodox, like Hirsch and others, backed away immediately.
Yeah.
It's the next generation or two that, you know, either they got tired of trying to defend it. I don't know. But you're exactly right.
Okay, I think we should.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Mendelssohn with Evan Mark.
Okay, absolutely.